Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Swetman, and we are continuing season 6 of the podcast, looking at the best films of 2020. These are streaming favorites from the year, as well as possible awards contenders for the coming months. So far, we've looked at movies like the great documentaries Dick Johnson is Dead and Welcome to Chechnya, and some notable indies like The Assistant. Coming up, we'll be looking at titles like Nomadland, One Night in Miami, On the Rocks, and many more. Today's movie is one that I would not be surprised to see winning some awards in a few months. It's called Mank, from director David Fincher, starring Gary Oldman, Amanda Seyfried, Lily Collins, and several other recognizable names. It tells the behind-the-scenes story, or a version of it, of the writing of one of the greatest films ever made, Citizen Kane. Gary Oldman plays the film's screenwriter, Herman Mankiewicz, Mank of the title, and follows his writing process, his dealings with Orson Welles, and his fascinating relationships with William Randolph Hearst and Marion Davies. It's a nitty-gritty look at kind of Hollywood royalty and sort of a mythical time in movie history. So this is definitely going to appeal to a lot of cinephiles. On this very podcast, back in episode 24, we discussed Citizen Kane as part of our classic movie starter pack. My guest for that season was Rance Collins, a writer and podcaster and basically a walking encyclopedia of classic Hollywood knowledge. So as soon as I heard that this was the subject of David Fincher's next movie, I knew Rance has got to be on the podcast. I've got to try to make that happen. So I'm very pleased that he is here. I'm having him back for sort of a follow-up in a way to our previous Citizen Kane discussion. Rance, thank you so much for coming back to the show. And how have you been?
I'm great. It's great to be back to the show. I I'm going to be watching all these movies as they hit streaming. So I'm just going to go ahead and throw my name in the hat. Have me back whenever you can't find somebody. Just be like, oh, maybe Rance will do it.
Just call
and I'll watch the movie.
that's something I've come to realize about you is I'm always like, should I ask? I don't want to bother him. And he's just like, yeah, you're always just down to do it.
Let's talk
do it in
about
5 minutes.
Movies.
Yeah.
So, let's talk about movies.
I love it. Well, Rance, when I had you on the podcast in the past, we've talked a lot about classic cinema. We've also talked a lot about the Oscars. I'll also stop here and recommend, by the way, Rance has another podcast, which is called The Envelope Please, in which he and his co-host Sam are podcasting through every Best Picture winner. And not only that, but giving me a ton of historical context for the Oscar ceremony year by year. It's fascinating. I haven't listened to all of it yet, but I make sure to listen regularly, and it's great. And he and Sam are so fun to listen to. So highly recommend that. So anyway, just before we get into Mank, I'm curious what you think about this coming Oscar season 2021, I guess. It's an unusual. What's your thoughts?
You know, it's so interesting because usually at about this time, we would know pretty succinctly what the nominees might be.
Yeah.
Because usually by this time, we've had quite a few movies released and we've had awards go out from some of the newspaper associations who always, you know, like New York Film Critics and, you know, all the different papers that give out awards typically do so in December. You know, we would have a clearer idea of where the season was heading. Yeah. But because of the extension and also because of the lack of theatrical releases or true theatrical releases, it's a whole new ball game.
Yeah.
There isn't the typical awards campaign season where, you know, if you were here in Los Angeles, you would know that award season is truly a season where there are a series of very hoity-toity industry events where, you know, people invite you to screenings through SAG or PGA or DGA and have Q&As and all things hosted for critics, things hosted for you know, people in the industry, and all of them are aimed at getting votes and awards. And that whole season just doesn't exist in the same way.
Is any of that kind of thing happening virtually? Is that possible? Or is it pretty much just not happening?
Well, yeah, I think that there are events happening virtually, especially like more of the press junket side of it. I don't know honestly, I do have a friend who used to work in awards who I need to talk to about this, actually, because I don't know if they're just doing, I mean, like, everything's already available digitally, yeah. You know, it's mm-hmm. so interesting. Everything's going to be released on these platforms. I'm sure these people are getting advanced screeners as mm-hmm. usual and whatnot. But I mean, everybody's just going to watch Mank on Netflix, yeah. you know, mm-hmm. everybody's just going to,
you have to see it a week early. Great. Like it's not,
yeah,
it's
no,
quite have the appeal.
It's,
yeah.
it's like a whole, and you know, hopefully this doesn't have, I think for those of us who truly love movies, mm-hmm. we're hoping that this doesn't have a negative effect in the future, because yeah. there are film distribution companies that are truly suffering yeah. right now, mm-hmm. Theater chains, and we need people. I just want to take this opportunity to say, when the opportunity to go back to the theater safely is there, which, you know, maybe this summer or next yeah. fall before mm-hmm. that happens, get out of the house and go to a movie theater.
Yeah.
You know, you've been watching movies at home for, you'll have been watching movies at home for a year and a half. You can go, you go to the movies and try to support the medium in the way that it was meant to be seen. Because I got to say, something like the movie that we're about to talk about, mm-hmm. I think would have really benefited from a theatrical experience.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and we're yeah. recording this just 2 days after the big Warner Brothers news about everything getting the mm-hmm. day and date streaming next year, and so everyone's anxious about what that means long term. So yes, it's a mess.
I feel like for yeah. Warner Brothers, that may be more of a move to try to get people to sign up for HBO Max.
Yeah, absolutely.
Honestly,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. because I feel a little bad for WB, because I think that I think the pandemic really screwed over their rollout for HBO Max mm-hmm.
yeah.
because the big thing that was going to happen was they were going to have that Friends reunion.
Oh yeah.
That was going to premiere the day that HBO Max rolled out. Yeah. And had that Friends reunion happened, they probably would have had a much different situation on day
yeah.
one,
yeah.
you know? Uh-huh. But it didn't happen because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
So
that and I've heard there's just been confusion because they have what HBO Next and HBO or Now and Go, and so
yeah,
there's this confusion around that. Yeah,
they could have. I mean, I'm sure everybody thought of this. Like, why didn't you just expand HBO Go? Why didn't
right.
you make it? Why wasn't it called Warner Brothers? Like, what was the, you yeah. know? But here they have Max.
Yeah.
They're going with it, and
yeah.
There is some interesting content coming out on HBO Max in the next few months, including
yeah.
some movies that will probably be in awards.
Yeah, and I'll go ahead and just
discussion.
Say too, I think it's for me, it's one of the better streaming services right now, because even beyond the theatrical stuff that's coming, it's got a lot of TCM stuff. So if you don't have TCM, you can watch a lot of classic movies. There's like a TCM hub on there, and then Studio Ghibli, if you're into anime stuff at all, those are streaming for the first time. Mm-hmm. So it has a large catalog, and I mean, and plus HBO,
I honestly think it
stuff,
has
but
the best collection of movies of any of the streaming
yeah.
platforms. It has the Criterion
yeah.
mm-hmm. collection.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the other, like Hulu and Netflix, are much more television focused,
yeah.
you know,
mm-hmm.
And over on HBO Max, you know, they have some good shows, as in, you know, they
yeah.
have, I don't know a lot about their originals, but they have some good documentaries, and they have some good historical WB programming,
yeah. mm-hmm.
but in HBO, and of course they have all of the HBO stuff, which is, you know, very high quality,
yeah.
but they have such a robust selection of films,
mm-hmm.
both classic and modern,
yeah.
That you can't find anywhere else.
Yeah, I was just looking today too, and they have a cool, in the classic section, they have this cool little Film School 101 thing, and so you can watch Casablanca right there, and Citizen Kane, and Jaws, and like all these huge titles that they've just got lined up for you. It's pretty cool. So anyway, enough HBO talk,
yeah.
I guess, but this movie is not on HBO. We're going to talk about Mank, which
it's
is a Netflix
original.
So there's your streaming breakdown for the
day. It is weird to me that I don't think Citizen Kane is streaming for free anywhere right now, is it?
Just on HBO Max, yeah.
Oh, it is on
it
HBO
is,
Max.
Yeah,
that's
it
right.
It is on there. So
it's
so Netflix
weird to
is
me
supporting
that
HBO in a way.
In a way, they are. It's a little surprising to me that they didn't like pay a ridiculous amount of money to put it on Netflix, because you would think they would want it to be there as like the perfect companion piece.
Yeah, it's a great double feature. Yeah.
But they didn't. Yeah, because. But I think regardless, this might end up benefiting HBO Max, because they might get some subscriptions from people curious to watch Citizen Kane now.
Yes.
And anything to get people to watch a classic is always good for me. So.
Yes, I agree. Well, with that in mind, let's, I guess, move on and talk about Mank.
It's a modern day version of Coyote.
Mank, it's Orson Welles. Houseman tells me we have you just where we want you.
I understand we've 90 days.
Let's aim for 60.
He's just got a month. LB, this is my brother, Joe.
Nice to meet you, Joseph.
Walk with me. What makes me cry? Emotion. Where do I feel emotion? Here, here, and here.
All right, let's talk about Mank. So, as I said at the top of the show, this film is about Herman Mankiewicz and the process of writing Citizen Kane, including a lot of the personal and professional relationships that fed into the story he was writing. It was directed by David Fincher, who also directed movies like Fight Club, The Social Network, and most recently, Gone Girl. The script for Mank was written by David Fincher's late father, Jack. And from what I've read, this has been sort of a passion project for David Fincher since his earliest days of being a filmmaker. He even had a different cast lined up at one point, I think in the 90s, but that was postponed. And so now it's finally here. And I must say, I'm a fan of it. It's got that whole like movies about movies thing going for it that critics tend to love and awards ceremonies tend to love. So I'm sure that will play into its success if it finds that. One thing I didn't expect was, I guess, how political this is. And in some of the modern residents of the political side of it. Rance, you are someone who is very interested in classic Hollywood and very interested in politics. So I'm curious, how did that mixture of kind of movies and politics, almost like political intrigue, work for you in this?
Well, it's interesting that they included that, because you don't hear a lot about it in that particular era. Usually you don't start hearing about politics mixing with movies in the way that people explore that period, at least, until you get to the communist witch hunt and the late 40s, early 50s. Mm-hmm. But very much so, you know, Louis B. Mayer was indeed a very active member of the Republican Party in California. Mm. And, you know, there was a lot of conversations that happened between Hollywood and Washington in those days, particularly because what isn't really discussed in the film, there was a whole movement after the 1920s brought about some salacious material in silent films, and then that kept going in the early era of sound in a period they call pre-code. And the pre-code movies had material that you don't necessarily expect to find in classic films, where people talk a little bit more frankly about sex and violence. And because of that, there was a risk that there was going to be federal censorship bans on movies. And that is why the Hays Code came into play in 1934 is when that went strictly into effect. And that was because they were trying to prevent federal government from getting in and censoring movies for them. So they were censoring themselves, basically. Okay. So a lot of that relationship had to do with keeping the industry afloat, keeping everything going. And in addition, I mean, you know, for the classic era, all the studios owned their own theaters. And so, which is apparently again possible because
I heard about that. Yeah.
Because it the Paramount decision of 48 law. Was struck down. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Politics and Hollywood were very much tied together. And of all of the studio heads, Louis Mayer was most certainly the most involved, at least with the Republican Party. So
that's really interesting.
It really, really is. And of course, we touch on William Randolph Hearst throughout the film, who indeed was the founding father of the type of journalism that has become so problematic.
Yes, yeah.
With cable news, so.
Yeah, I listened back to our discussion of Citizen Kane, and we kind of talked about that back then, about, you know, the yellow journalism we see in that film is very much, the model and being exploited in political arenas, just the way we see in Citizen Kane happening. So it's very interesting.
The way we see in Mank, whenever they're that scene at the beach when they're listening to the radio and he recognizes the woman's voice and knows it's an actress who's or a rich lady who's actually not poor, but
I'm telling the story about I'm poor and that's why I'm voting Republican in this election and all that. All the Up and Sinclair stuff was really interesting and informative for me because I'm I feel like it's a jumping off point. I should probably like read actual history books about this because it's really fascinating, and I'm curious how much they, because it really seemed to align interestingly with modern elections. He's almost a Bernie Sanders like figure talking about socialist revolutions and all of that. And also, I mean, there's just a familiar feeling with watching election results and just being really disappointed with what happens. but
I thought visually speaking, that election party scene was probably the most striking in the film. That was a very interesting sequence. So story-wise, there's a lot to mine politically for sure.
Yeah, and then the whole propaganda storyline, so the studio's actually making propaganda films and kind of where that goes, which I won't spoil. That was just a really compelling part of this movie, and I just didn't expect any political stuff. So that was pretty interesting. Maybe that can kind of transition into just talking historically in general about this. So again, when you and I talked about Citizen Kane, at that point, we kind of broke down the Mankiewicz family tree. I don't think we need to fully rehash that, but it's interesting because you know a Mankiewicz personally.
Yes, I know the grandson of the person this movie's about. Yes.
Ben Mankiewicz. So that's Herman's grandson. Have you heard? I actually found a quote from him online, but I'm curious, have you heard any reaction from him or his family about this?
I haven't talked to him personally about this, but I guess I'm just as informed as you are on his on his reactions, because I've just seen the interviews and read about them. But yes, for quite a while, up until this year, actually, I was his assistant. I've transitioned to other work since then, but I still am a freelance writer for Turner Classic Movies, and I write some of the scripts that end up going that he ends up repeating on air. He edits them, but so I have been in my head at least once a month when I write some of these scripts, as I try to mimic his way of speaking.
So you have sort of some personal hooks into this movie, then. It's kind of an interesting
way. Yes.
Yeah.
But Ben is someone I know pretty well, and he is a writer as well, just like his grandfather. And while he doesn't write screenplays, he is someone with a journalism background, and he is very particular and very perfectionist in everything that he does. And it was interesting to watch a movie about his grandfather, where you see some of those same shades of perfectionism and fighting for your work. So I definitely see personality similarities.
Well, I can read the quote that I found. I think he was on It was, he was interviewed by Deadline or something. I'll link it in the show notes if I can find it. But here's the quote was, it fully comports with my image of my grandfather, as relayed by mostly by my father, but also my mother, the few years that she got to spend with him, that he was the smartest person in the room, the funniest person in the room, even when he had been drinking, which was often, and that he was never mean, ever. My father really admired him, even though, of course, he wished he hadn't self-destructed in the way that he did. So that was really interesting. And yeah, if that's true, then I think the movie got it right in that way, because I think that some of those scenes where they're sitting around the fire talking with at these social events are probably the most compelling parts for me, just kind of listening to the banter and
yes,
the political. And yeah, he's clearly drunk and kind of poking at people, but in a way that's respectful somehow, or at least good natured, I think. But yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. Definitely those scenes. I thought all the sequences with Marion Davies were the strongest for me. Mm-hmm. And she's always in those group scenes. I think that Amanda Seyfried.
Yes, Seyfried, I think, yeah.
Seyfried. I think that she pulls out a very strong... I fully expect her to get a Best Supporting Actress nomination.
Yeah.
She does a very good job. And I think that the actors should all be commended too for the way that they embody the speech patterns of the day, and the kind of transatlantic accent that was in vogue at the time. There is a there's an authenticity to their performances that I don't always see in period films. Mm-hmm. I think the strongest parts of the movie, the two strongest elements, are the acting and the writing.
Yeah, I was going to call out Amanda Seyfried as well as probably my favorite performance in it. I think she's just really, I don't know, great screen presence. And also, yeah, from what I know of the period, seemed to kind of nail that. The other one that I think was just so much fun to watch was, his name is Arliss Howard as Louis B. Mayer. And just he's larger than life feeling a little bit, and also very manipulative, but really funny. I thought it was a great performance from him.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
There's definitely, I also, what's the actor's name? The guy who does Orson Welles.
Yeah, I was going to mention him too. Tom Burke is his name.
Yeah. Tom Burke. He doesn't look exactly like him, but he does nail his, I mean, he sounds exactly like him.
The voice is perfect. Yeah.
The voice was the perfect. And in the scenes where he's just disembodied on the phone, I thought it was, is that Orson Welles?
Yeah.
It was a very, that was very, very good.
Yeah. I meant to look this up too, but at the end, there's a clip of an interview. And I was like, I was wondering, is that actually the real interview from Orson Welles, or is this the Tom Burke actor again? And I don't know the answer to that. Maybe I can look it up in a second here, but
I don't actually know the answer to that too. I assumed it was real based on the fact that it sounded different than everything else we had heard.
Yeah, I think it probably must be, because it also just a blank screen and it kind of gives you context and a caption of what's happening. So yeah, it must be. I'm gonna just assume that it is.
Yeah, I feel like that's fair.
Well, I wanted to talk too about, I mean, the historical accuracy of this, because that's another huge question and kind of hotly debated. And I'm kind of only dipping my toes into understanding all the controversy around it, but who actually wrote this movie is, that's a big question. Who actually wrote Citizen Kane, that is. Some people claim that Orson Welles was more involved, and others saying he wasn't at all. So I wondered, can you break down some of the different ideas around that question?
Yeah, that's where this movie, I think, gets a little hard to track, and where people might have issues, is most accounts seem to agree that Orson Welles had a very heavy hand in writing the film. And this takes a much more justice for the writers position, which is a message that I really, really like and respond to. But I'm not quite sure that in this particular instance, it's entirely accurate.
Yeah.
Like, I think it was more of a, like a the truth is halfway, you know, it's right. Not all Orson Welles and it's not all Herman Mankiewicz. It's something between those two narratives. And I mean, quite certainly, Herman Mankiewicz was a brilliant writer, as was his brother Joe, who's far more well known and who we talked a lot about on All About Eve.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And he just has a small part in this movie, and you don't really get an idea of the impact he would end up having. I mean, like, honestly, it's Herman Mankiewicz's life ends up being rather sad because he does go – he is gone way too early because of whatever personal demons he might have had. But you know, in a way, I think the intention behind this movie is almost to restore – the legacy of an unsung hero of the golden age, whose life was kind of overshadowed by his brother, who would become this Oscar darling and who would make movies that might not outshine Citizen Kane historically, but there's more of him and his name is on top of them, as opposed to Herman's, who is, you know, who's dwarfed by Orson Welles.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that the movie maybe probably overstates the amount of impact. Not the impact. I think it probably overstates how little Orson Welles did.
Right.
With the script, but I think ultimately the intention is good enough that it can be forgiven.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I think I agree with that. So my understanding of kind of the issue is that, you know, we have this tendency to idolize directors and assume that no one else did anything on the movie, right? And especially someone like Orson Welles, who I think it was even in his contract that he was, you know, writing, producing all that. And that's why he, the original contract wrote Mankiewicz out of the screenwriting credit. And so,
how interesting is it, though, that this comes from somebody... that this movie comes from somebody who is himself an auteur, you know?
That is very interesting. Yeah.
Like a person making a movie arguing for you to credit the writer. And I mean, this writer, was written director, by somebody else.
Yeah.
It was written by a relative, which is interesting.
Yeah.
But I mean, ultimately he is a writer director and he does, ultimately going to be the one who gets all the credit for this film, you know?
Yeah.
So
that's a very good point. Yeah,
it's just an interesting interesting parallel, and I'm not saying it is his movie, clearly, but will we wonder will there be an origin story years from now about how much of this movie is him and how much is his dad, like, I mean, are we gonna get that meta?
Yikes.
It's an interesting concept, and I think that's ultimately what the purpose of the movie is. I think the purpose of the film is to make sure that it is to give some credit to writers who don't get credit.
Yeah.
So
absolutely. And that seems to be, so I watched a YouTube explainer video talking about the history of the debate around this, and one big thing in it is that in 1971, Pauline Kael, the renowned film critic, she wrote this piece that basically said what this movie says, that Orson Welles did almost nothing and that Herman Mankiewicz wrote all this and didn't get any credit. It seems like since then scholars have pretty much debunked that and said that Pauline Kael was way off, that he actually had a lot to do, Welles had a lot to do with this, and so that's another interesting thing. So it seems like since Pauline Kael, her theory has been proven wrong, and yet this movie's kind of siding with her in a way. And interestingly too, one thing I read is that David Fincher said at some point that he did edit the Mank script that his father wrote because he felt it was too anti-Orson Welles. So I can only imagine, because this definitely isn't like a pro-Orson Welles film. So that's an interesting thing that it was even more anti in a way, apparently.
You can't deny, if you watch Citizen Kane, you can't deny that the way... the movie exists in this vacuum in 1941, where all of the stuff that's in the movie didn't happen before the film was made.
Yeah.
And, you know, Herman Mankiewicz had been working in Hollywood for a decade at that point. And the other people who were in the film had been working for a long time. And sure, and maybe it's part that this movie was made without very much interference from the studio. And so all of these people were able to go as far as they were able to creatively, but you can't take Orson Welles out of that.
Yeah.
Because clearly he had an influence in the narrative structure, in the editing style and the cinematography. Like, clearly you can't take Welles out of that.
Right. And that's so much of the legacy of it, is the technical genius of it and all of that. And actually that maybe kind of transitioned too, because I wanted to talk about, there are some interesting connections between Mank and Citizen Kane, even like stylistically, structurally. So yeah, what do you have thoughts around that?
I have to say, like, this is probably the area that's going to get the most praise, and yet it's where I start to have some issues.
Interesting.
Yes, I couldn't. Okay, this is a problem that a lot of people probably will not have, but I, after living in LA for so long, have seen a lot of movies on 35 millimeter film in movie theaters.
Yeah,
and we don't do that anymore as a culture. Everything's digital, but there are lots of movies that are still shot on 35 millimeter because people want to have the look of a 35 millimeter film, because there is something about it that I think is a noticeable quality that is kind of magical. And if you want an example of that, you can look at, last year a Netflix movie called Marriage Story came out, and it was shot on film. And if you watch it, you can tell there is a quality about it that maybe isn't as crisp as digital, but there is a quality about digital that can look, as detailed as it may be, it can look really flat. And my issue with the visual look was that I felt quite often the picture looked like desaturated color and not like black and white, because it was very clearly shot on digital and then everything was done in post. And I really question why all of this work was done to mimic technology that Fincher clearly had the budget and the ability to use. Like, he could have just gotten black and white film stock and shot it on film, because if you had used black and white film stock, then you would have been able to, because what the movie doesn't have visually is the blacks are not black. You know, there's something in digital where it's, the blacks kind of have a gray about them. And that contrast is what I feel was missing. It felt very soft for the starkness of what black and white is. So that is something I could tell they were trying. And there's times where trying is a little too much for me, because, you know, you have the little cigarette burn
film noise
from the reel changes and all that stuff. And it's a cute touch, but it's it's fake, you know?
When and you could have done the real thing.
When you could have done the real thing. I just am very confused. It's also not like Fincher hasn't shot on film before. For the last decade, he shot digitally, but he he clearly, up until the late 2000s, shot on film. He knows how to do it. Netflix was threw clearly a ton of money into this film. They could have afforded film. I don't understand. It really confuses me. And I think I think the movie would have really benefited from that. There's still some amazing sequences visually, and all of the shot selections, angles, and what they're going for with lighting is great. But I challenge, somebody on Twitter posted a picture of a shot of Johnny Depp walking between sound stages in Ed Wood, and then a similar shot from this movie. And just looking at the two side by side, you can see there is a classic quality that is missing.
Wow. I would love to find that tweet and try to link that, because that sounds really interesting. Yeah, that's a criticism that is really interesting, and one that I didn't really think of. I did think, I don't know, thinking about like digital black and white, that's something that, so like in this film, they were clearly trying so hard to make it seem authentically, you know, of that period, or at least mimic that in a way that's artistically creative. But then I think about something like Roma a couple of years ago with Alfonso Cuarón, where he very intentionally said, we're going to go digital and black and white and like embrace the digital. And that film is breathtakingly beautiful, I think, because he's not trying to make it like an older black and white movie. He's kind of pushing to something kind of creatively new. So anyway.
There's a reason that you make certain decisions and whether or not you choose to shoot on film or digital, which they do both quite frequently today. There's a reason why a lot of the big budget films end up being film. It's because they want a certain look. And as great an advance as digital has made in the last decade, there is still a quality that is very hard to mimic, because film is a physical medium.
It's real
as opposed to a digital medium.
Yeah.
I mean, it is something where you are capturing something with light on a physical piece of celluloid. And that intrinsically has a depth to it that cannot be mimicked with a series of numbers.
Yeah, and you're right. This seems like a perfect film to just choose film. Like, if you have given the choice, why not choose film in this case?
Also, weird to choose why not go with the classic aspect ratio?
Oh, yeah, you know, I think of that. Yeah,
like I mean, I understand maybe you didn't want to do that to confuse people, but why go with? They didn't even go with 16:9. They went with 2:35:1, and why do that when you could have more aptly mimicked the period? It's just like it's just with as the amount of intention that went into every aspect of the art direction and the post-production end of this, it's just confusing to me why they didn't make things so much easier.
that's incredibly valid to my ears. That makes a lot of sense. And on that note too, one thing that they did to kind of be quote unquote authentic was, I read about the score, which is Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, who I'm a big fan of. And I think this is a good score. It's not like my favorite score of the year, but they used all kind of period instruments, which is unusual for them because they usually do all this electronic.
Score was great.
I
really like the score. I will say that.
It's a departure in a way. Design. Yeah, the sound design too. Yeah,
the sound design. It takes a little getting used to when you're first watching, because it and I couldn't decide if I liked it for a little bit, because it is harder to make out, and there were times where I felt like it was harder to make out than watching an actual movie of the period. But it did sound like the way I think of the sound design of Citizen Kane.
Yeah,
being
reading a tweet or something about that the recording equipment they used mimicked that. It does. It sounds different. It sounds kind of quote unquote, I don't know, old timey or something, which is funny too.
Tinny
in a way. Yeah, there's almost a little echo to it or something. But it also sounded rich in a way too. So it, and I listened through AirPods while on my streaming box. So how hilarious to hear like old timey audio in the most.
And I appreciate that when people were driving in cars, you know, the backdrop looked like a rear projection as opposed to like I get the intentionality of that stuff. And I do appreciate that. It's just really the one thing, like, why didn't they shoot on film? That's the only thing. It also would have really helped them in covering up how Gary Oldman was much older than the character he was playing. Gary Oldman does a great job. I don't want to, but he is at a lot of this movie is supposed to be in his 30s, and no matter how hard a life you lived,
yeah,
you're not going to look like you're in your fifth. You're not going to look 60 when you're in your.
Yeah.
When you're in your, I think he's 58 in real life. You're not going to look 58 when you're 32.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that
is. That's an interesting thing, too. I read a little, it was just some of his thoughts about playing this character, and he's used to playing under lots of prosthetics. And he has Winston Churchill last year in a lot of different makeups and just all the crazy Harry Potter characters he's played and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so to have nothing, and this was a choice by David Fincher, and kind of an interesting one. Yeah.
I think it really works for his, for the quote unquote present day.
Time. Yeah.
The 1940, 1941 stuff. That stuff makes sense to me. It's just when we flash back, I feel like the stuff between him and Marion Davies is a little harder to. I mean, it helps that William Randolph Hearst is so much older than her that he doesn't seem as that much older than her. But I think they're supposed to be in the same age range. So
yeah,
or almost the same age exactly.
They definitely don't feel that way in some of those conversations.
They don't feel like contemporaries. They still feel like a father daughter.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't want to, all of this criticism aside, I still think it's a good movie.
Yeah.
I'm doing that thing where you critique film, you know.
Yes, of course. Well, speaking of the flashbacks, I think that's one of the things that I thought was, you know, probably a good choice plot-wise to mimic Citizen Kane in a way that we have. We're jumping around in time. It's not as complex as Citizen Kane, which jumps back and forth and sideways and forward, where this is you know, pretty much one storyline with cuts back. But I think it's an effective way to provide context for, you know, the quote unquote present day of the story. So I thought the plotting of it and all the dialogue was really well written.
And the writing was, I think the writing was the strongest element. Aside from, as I said, I do, and I think Gary Oldman gives a great performance. I'm just only talking about age difference here, being a little confusing, because it, you know, it's only you can almost like get away with it just because you don't really know how old he is until the moment where he says his age, and he says he's 42, and you're just like, oh,
interesting,
it's not the age I was getting.
Yeah.
Watching this, but I mean. It still is a very good movie, and the writing is good. Okay. Yeah. Anyway,
I would think so. I need to I'm sure someone will break this down in the next week or two, but there are several parallel shots that I noticed between Citizen Kane and Mank too, you know, laying in a hospital bed and someone kind of coming in soft focus in the background. And that happens a few times here. And I seem to remember that from Citizen Kane. Are there other things like that I'm missing that were kind of like Easter eggs almost?
I mentioned this earlier, the scene with the election. The editing style during that period in particular reminded me of several of the montage sequences that are in Citizen Kane. And, you know, the montage sequences that mix in those extreme close-ups and the, a lot of it, I don't even think was necessarily direct visual nods, just you could tell that the way they were framing and editing and lighting things was very much in ode to Citizen Kane.
So you mentioned earlier kind of the age difference there. I wanted to mention too, Charles Dance, I think, does a great job. He's not in it very much, but I mean, I know him primarily from Game of Thrones. I know he's in a lot more stuff than that, but I thought he was really good, particularly in the scene near the end, the kind of the dinner party that goes wrong, just kind of his reactions to Gary Oldman and almost an amused kind of a face, but obviously exuding a lot of like power and like distaste as well. I thought it was really a good performance from him.
Yeah, no, Charles Dance was very, very good as William Randolph Hearst. I enjoyed all of the locations they used as well. It was nice to, although I will say, Easter egg for anyone who's curious, they do use a, like, they are on the Paramount lot when they're on the Paramount lot.
Interesting.
They are outside of MGM gates during that scene where he gives the old homeless friend of his a dollar.
And
you do see those real life locations. But what I thought was so interesting is they depict a scene that really did happen of Marion Davies moved her production company from MGM to Warner Brothers. And there was a, she had a huge bungalow that they dismantled and took away on truck beds over to from Culver City, which is where MGM was located, over to Burbank, where Warner Brothers is. And the funny thing is, the scene where that happens, they are on the Warner Brothers lot when it's supposed to be MGM. They clearly added in the huge MGM sign and post, but he runs up and he's right by stage 15 at WB, which when I was a tour guide there, I helped do audience load-ins for Conan O'Brien, who was shooting at the stage at the time. And then the reverse shot shows stage 20 and 25 with the backside of the back lot of New York Street on the opposite side of 25. 25 is where they shot Big Bang Theory. And so that line of stages they're showing is Warner Brothers.
Wow.
So she's already where she's supposedly trucking her sets. Yeah, she's already trucking that bungalow over to. So I don't know why they couldn't get on. They were showing the outside of the MGM lot earlier, which is now where Sony Pictures is located. But I guess they couldn't, either they couldn't get onto the, they couldn't get inside the gate for whatever reason, or they, or maybe they just didn't think it had the look they wanted for the scene, because they have, that studio has been updated a little bit more in appearance than Paramount or Warner Brothers has been. So. I don't know.
This is why we have rants on the podcast, because who else would have this deep cut knowledge of the lots they shot on? It's fascinating. I love it.
Once a tour guide, always a tour guide. I was a tour guide at Warner Brothers for 3.5 years. If you have any questions about that lot, please let me know.
Rants,
I love it. I know it. And that's, yes.
There you go. Well, I wanted to...
But in case you're wondering, they shot Citizen Kane. If you want to know where they shot Citizen Kane, they shot it between the two RKO lots. There are two... RKO was spread out across a couple of lots. But there is one that it was right by Paramount. And that lot... And Paramount eventually absorbed that lot after... RKO went under. There was a brief period where it was held by Desilu, but then Desilu was bought by Paramount, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, and then there was a lot right across the street from MGM in Culver City, which is where other parts of Citizen Kane were likely shot. So
interesting.
On Washington Boulevard. There you go.
There you go.
So RKO, that's the studio who was behind it. There's also a really great movie. If you enjoyed this one, there's a really great HBO film called RKO 281. Is that right? 281?
I think that's right. Yeah, I haven't watched it.
Yeah.
You mentioned it on the Citizen Kane episode. That's why I remember that.
Yeah, it's a great film that also has a great cast that talks about the making of Citizen Kane with more of a slant towards Orson Welles.
Interesting. Nice double feature with this then.
Yeah, it tells a very different... It's like, it's arguing the other side of this, basically. So
that is very interesting.
With Herman, I don't remember Herman Mankiewicz having a very large part in that, so...
Yeah, there you go.
Anyway.
Well, I want to ask you, too, and kind of a side question, just about David Fincher. I haven't seen all of his work, but I think... how does this compare to other David Fincher movies for you? And do you feel any... commonalities between any of them? It seems kind of unique in a way among his other filmography.
I mean, like, I guess Benjamin Button would be the closest.
Yeah, think of that. Yeah.
Yeah, because that one's the only other one I can think of that has that Hollywood, old Hollywood feel to it.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Because this doesn't connect at all in my head to Gone Girl or Fight Club or any of those films. This feels, it's a totally different Fincher for sure.
Yeah. The only commonality I could think of was possibly with The Social Network, because it is kind of, you know, behind the scenes of business kind of decisions and backstabbing and kind of intrigue and all of that. And there actually is a little bit of a parallel moment that I felt with in The Social Network. You remember there's a kind of a famous scene where Andrew Garfield's character runs in and smashes the laptop, Mark Zuckerberg's laptop.
Oh, yeah.
And there's sort of a parallel here towards the end, which I won't spoil, but something gets smashed because of a business dispute near the end of this film too. So I think that's kind of a funny.
And I mean, connection. It's real life people. And,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is, so this is his next, I think those are the only two biographical movies he's done.
Yeah, I'm looking at his filmography. I think that's true. I mean, besides Mindhunter with his Netflix show, which I have not watched, but it's all
Mindhunter is I forgot. But I haven't watched Mindhunter either, but
I'm kind of afraid
but
to.
But I've heard it's very good. I probably enjoy it. I do enjoy true crime. So this is it's interesting. I still think Gone Girl is my favorite Fincher. I think
that's
that remains
one I haven't seen. Amazingly, I've seen The Game, and which I really liked The Game back in the day. And I've seen think everything else except for Zodiac. I haven't seen Zodiac either.
Oh, Zodiac! So I need to. Maybe Zodiac.
Oh, and that's a true Zodiac story too. Yeah, actually.
Yeah. Oh, I did forget about that. But Zodiac is a true story, but it also it's like JFK in a way, his version of JFK, I guess you could say, because it presents a theory.
Yeah, interesting.
To who the it makes a decision on who it thinks the Zodiac killer is, which is not a known fact because we do not know who the Zodiac was.
That's very point. In a way, this movie does that with about who wrote Citizen Kane. You know, it's saying, well, we're going to present this side, so maybe
but I wouldn't connect these. I mean, like, the thing that's different about that, the thing that's different about Gone Girl and The Social, like, those are still linear movies, you know, which I think is why maybe Benjamin Mutton feels like the most because it does jump back and forth mm-hmm. and it does show segments of time in a life. So
interesting.
It relies very heavily. It was shot on film, but it relies very heavily on digital effects, yes. post production.
Yes.
So,
interesting.
But anyway, it's a good. I think I give it 3.5 out of 5.
All right, interesting. I'd probably go a little higher, but I'm not sure. I always take forever to actually think of a star rating on Letterboxd and stuff. So I put way too much pressure on myself. But
I sometimes revise, but I like to put my gut out there before I think too much about it, because I your initial reaction is still your
It's important.
And I also want to do it before I get influenced by anything anyone else says. Anywho, what I think the funny thing is, like, you know, I recently went through all of the James Bond movies.
Yeah.
So whenever you do a No Time to Die episode, let me know. Whenever that ends up coming out.
Yes, you'll be the go-to person. Yeah.
But it's funny, if you would look through my James Bond rating, you would discover that you can question my taste in everything I've said, because I gave Moonraker 4 out of 5 stars, but I gave Mank 3.5 out of 5.
You have the opposite take of most people on James Bond movies. Yeah, that's really funny.
Moonraker is a lot of fun. That's all I'm going to say.
That's another huge thing. I haven't seen that many James Bond movies. I've not seen Moonraker, but I understand it's
It's
not considered the best. Generally,
it's in space.
There's
he doesn't have his usual gun. He has a laser.
Yeah, you know, my point of reference for Moonraker is in the video game, the N64 game. There's a Moonraker gun, and it's a laser gun. So I think there you go.
There is a whole in space laser gun battle in Moonraker.
Oh, so I think you like, play that in the game. I thought you were referencing the game. Sorry, I'm the video game.
No, this is in the movie. In a James Bond movie, he is in space on a space station, having a laser gun fight. And if you can't have a good time watching that,
something's wrong.
Then you don't deserve to watch movies.
You heard it here.
Exactly.
That's hilarious. Well, it sounds like we both recommend Mank. So go watch Mank. It is streaming now on Netflix. And thank you again so much for coming back. And yes, for real, if we do No Time to Die, you'll be my go-to on that. So welcome back anytime.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Art House Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes now, and you can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. If you want to support Art House Garage, you can leave a rating or review in your podcast app, or you can buy an Art House Garage t-shirt or hat. We have some cool merch at arthousegarage.com/shop. You can stay in the loop about Art House Garage and the things we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter. That is at arthousegarage.com/subscribe. Or you can always email me directly, Andrew, at arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Art House Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob free.